From Alaska to Florida, Virginia to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, a sweeping proposal to overhaul the nation's tax code is on the table, and it would bring dramatic changes to both personal and business taxes. Will McBride of the Tax Foundation joins us with details. The Obama budget and the Texas primary are on Andy Roth's mind this week. He joins us with the real story. SolarCity is the hot new solar energy firm on Wall Street, but what happens when the federal subsidies end? Tori Richards joins Eric Boehm for a Watchdog radio report. And Ronald Reagan's 11 principles of conservatism powered the GOP to two presidential election victories and a generation of conservative government. Dr. Paul Kangor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Congressman David Kemp is chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and he has proposed wide-ranging changes to the nation's tax code. Will McBride is the chief economist at the Tax Foundation. He has been studying the chairman's reform package, and he's here now to explain. Will, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Will, Dave Kemp, who is chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, came out with a tax reform plan, very broad-based plan. He's been working on it for a long period of time. Can you give us an overview on what it is the chairman is proposing?
He is proposing a really full-blown rewrite of the income tax code, federal income tax code. So this hasn't been done since 1986. And very much that is the model this go-round. Dave Kemp has explicitly pointed to the Tax Reform Act of 1986 as a big success and one that he would like to replicate. And basically what happened there was a lowering of tax rates for individuals and businesses in exchange for a broader tax base, so a broader definition of income. So that's what he has accomplished here. He did lower the rates, and the individual was aiming for 25%, and he got it down to 35% on the individual side when you count this. There's a 10% surtax on high-income earners. And then on the corporate side, he got it down to 25%, as he had promised, and he moved to a territorial tax system, which is a big deal for multinational corporations. They've been pushing for it for years. It's basically what every other country does except us. They exempt largely the foreign income of multinational corporations. Just makes things easier, basically. Current system is just not workable. We try to tax multinationals no matter where they earn their profits. So these are all big simplifications, and they are to be commended. In addition, he had many boxes he was in, particularly the static revenue scoring box. That means that any sort of tax rates had to be paid for by tax increases elsewhere. And so that's the base broadening part. And so the big base broadener pay for was it hit businesses, all kinds of businesses, small, big. And that is, it changes their depreciation schedules. So their businesses, most people that don't own a business aren't aware of this, but businesses don't get to write off their capital expenses, their purchases of machines and other equipment and structures. They don't get to write those off immediately. They are amortized or depreciated over a number of years, even decades in the case of structures. So what that does is it effectively reduces those write-offs because of people. Everybody would rather have their write-offs sooner rather than later. And so what this proposal does is extend those lives even further for tax purposes. So that effectively raises taxes on those businesses that are doing a lot of capital purchases, the capital-intensive companies such as manufacturing and other capital-intensive industries.
Now, for individuals, we'll have this simplification where there will be fewer tax brackets. Will individuals be losing any of the deductions that they can currently take?
Certainly. There is a whole rearrangement of the rules of the game, I would say. Lots of changes. The big ones for individuals, there's a change in retirement accounts, our 401ks, Roth IRAs, IRAs. There's generally there's a number of provisions that encourage taxpayers to pay their taxes up front and by using Roth IRAs for retirement purposes, and then excluding the returns on those investments when they're withdrawn sometime later. So sort of moves, it's kind of an effect, it's essentially an equivalent treatment in a lot of ways, but it just sort of brings in more revenue for the federal government up front and reduces revenue out in future years. It's going to impact different people in different ways. And people that like to use their 401ks as their primary investment account, which is most people who are employees, they are going to be severely limited by this. The cap for 401ks is cut in half under this, so it drops to 8,000 something. So I think that affects not a majority of taxpayers. Certainly a majority of higher income taxpayers will be affected by that. Anyone who's putting more than 8,000 currently into their 401k a year. I'll just go over another one briefly. They're dealing with the home mortgage interest deduction. That's a big one. Costs a lot of money every year. A lot of people take it, particularly upper, middle, and high-income people. It's currently capped, the mortgage interest deduction capped at $1 million loan. You cannot deduct interest payments on any more than $1 million loan. They propose to cut that cap in half to $500,000. Those are just some of the deductions. There's a complete change of the personal exemption that's eliminated and replaced with a much larger standard deduction. There's larger deductions for children, and then that is offset by smaller deductions, a smaller credit for the earned income tax credit for low income filers. So there's just many, many changes that are all mixed up together. The end result is that there is apparently a tax cut for most taxpayers earning less than $100,000, and then those earning more than $100,000, as far as we can tell right now, we get a slight tax increase.
What would the chances be of this actually happening? Is given the current climate, the political climate in Congress, is it reasonable to expect that Congress is going to be able to tackle something as complex with as many special interests as tax reform and actually get something done?
It's very contentious, and this bill or this proposal has been discussed publicly for 3 years. There's been numerous discussion drafts about different aspects of it, particularly dealing with businesses, and it hasn't united the business community, that's for sure. It's tended to divide the business community. There's certain winners and losers. That's sort of the nature of doing revenue-neutral tax reform. I mean, it's hard to avoid that.
And, Will, if we have listeners who would like additional information, perhaps like to read some of your writings on this topic, where can they go on the web to get that?
So you can go to taxfoundation.org, and we do lots of different types of publications, but we have a blog post, and I encourage everybody to check it out. But we're going to continue to do more and more analysis using our model that will come out over the next days and weeks.
Will McBride, Chief Economist at the Tax Foundation. Will, thank you for being here.
Okay, thank you.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, having a busy week in Washington, D.C. with both policy and politics, so we will get right to it. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Well, we have been discussing Chairman Camp's tax reform proposals. We'd be interested in the Club's take on what has been offered.
We like the idea that he did it, first of all. We like that it's generally pro-growth, and we like that he's reducing rates and broadening the base. That's pushing the tax code to a flatter, more fair, more simple tax code. A couple of things we want to quibble with, and they're very important, is that he is now taxing capital gains and dividends as ordinary income. Now, there's a large exclusion included so that the overall tax hit may be considered a tax cut for most people, but pro-growth conservatives do not believe in taxing capital gains at the same rate as ordinary income. This is effectively what is called the Buffett rule. So Republicans, even though they didn't need to, are giving a fig leaf to the Democrats in their proposal. So we didn't like that. The other thing is that part of the revenue that will be generated from this tax reform proposal is going to be spent on the highway fund. And that is blow your mind dumb. The term highway fund should not be included in any tax reform proposal. And the only reason why it is because the gas tax is not generating enough income or enough revenue for the big spenders in Washington to spend on bridges and roads and bike paths and mass transit. So they're trying to give the trust fund more money without raising taxes, gas taxes. So those are two really dumb ideas, but overall it's a great start, and it's a discussion that I think we can have and improve upon.
Well, it's good to see that we are starting down that path. However, another path that is well-worn is President Obama pro-offering a budget, a federal budget. In years past, on occasion, it's gotten zero votes in the U.S. Senate. He has put a budget out again. And any highlights or lowlights to speak of?
It's basically a campaign document. It's going to be treated with disdain from Congress, just like in years past. And I hope that will be a part of his legacy. But it basically does a lot of things that appeals to the Democrat base: income inequality, increasing the minimum wage, unemployment benefits, on and on and on. But the legacy part that I mentioned, that's what's really important, because if after Obama is gone, and that can't come soon enough, but after Obama has left the White House, I think a lot of commentators will talk about how, even though there were huge deficits at the beginning, Obama was able to cap federal spending and keep a tight lid on it. Well, that may be true on the budgets that ultimately passed, but that wasn't his preferred route. The budgets that passed were because of the gridlock in Congress, thanks to Republicans in the House. If Obama had had his way, he would have totally blown the lid off of the budget and the lid off the national debt. So when historians are recreating his legacy, I hope they'll keep that in mind and not the fact that spending was somewhat contained over the last few years of his administration.
Speaking of political, we had a big primary election a couple of days ago in the great state of Texas, and the media is sort of trying to portray it as a loss for the Tea Party. Can you explain that a little bit?
The biggest one is the Senate race. John Cornyn, Senator John Cornyn, had a primary challenge from Congressman Steve Stockman. And Steve Stockman is kind of considered a Tea Party candidate. The only problem is that Stockman's candidacy was never that serious. He announced right before the filing deadline. He did not consult with his grassroots support. He didn't consult with outside groups that would maybe help him. It was just sort of a kamikaze mission that was doomed from the start. Like you said, the liberal media want to claim that, this is the Tea Party proving that it's losing its steam. Well, no, it's just this was a candidate that who wasn't viable or who didn't try to energize the base. The base probably would have been there if he would have proven himself to be a worthwhile candidate. There were a few other races throughout the state where there were primary challenges. Texas has a runoff system. So if you hold the incumbent below 50%, then you go into a runoff. There is Congressman Ralph Hall, who I believe is 90 years old, who got only 45%. So he's going to be going up against a Republican challenger named John Ratcliffe, who I believe is to Hall's right. So there's definitely an anti-incumbent atmosphere out there. Not just in the Senate race and in this Ralph Hall race, but there were other races as well where I think that there were more challenges to incumbents than you can typically expect. But we shouldn't measure the Tea Party's value based on their win-loss record. I think we should measure it on how many incumbents are being challenged, because maybe they won't win this election cycle, but I'll bet you they'll be winning more and more in the years to come. You're already going to see that later on this month or later on this election season, I believe.
And in a rare instance of the lieutenant governor's race actually being highly competitive and of interest, the incumbent lieutenant governor didn't fare so well last week, did he?
No, there's some irony here. David Dewhurst is the lieutenant governor, and he is a millionaire in his own right and is able to typically write checks to get him into the office that he wants. He tried to do this in 2012 against Ted Cruz. Dewhurst vastly outspent Cruz, but Cruz ultimately won. Because of that loss, I think Dewhurst has lost his welcome in elected politics. He's been lieutenant governor for more than 10 years, I believe, and now that he's running again, he only got 28% in the primary. Dan Patrick, who's more conservative than him, got 42%. Now, of course, because of the rules, this will go into a runoff. And maybe Dewhurst will be able to pull it out, but the fact that he couldn't even secure first place in a primary shows that his days are probably numbered, and hopefully he'll go and bounce his grandkids on his knee rather than continue to abuse tax dollars in Texas.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, and let's close as usual with a couple of words about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 100,000 members all across the country from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic liberty. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, chat with you next week.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
With the failure of Solyndra on many minds, eyes are now on Solar City to see if a solar energy firm can actually survive in the free market. Watchdog.org's national reporter, Tori Richards, joins Eric Baim for this Watchdog Radio Report.
Everyone has heard about Solyndra, the Obama administration's epic fail in the realm of solar energy. But have you heard about the newest solar energy company whose stocks are soaring on the backs of taxpayer-funded government programs? Hi, folks. I'm Eric Baim with Watchdog Radio, and today we're talking about Solar City, a California-based company that has been in the news recently because it's been one of the hottest green energy stocks on Wall Street. But joining us today is Tori Richards. She's a national reporter for Watchdog.org and a colleague of mine, and she's going to tell us what she found when she pulled back the curtain on Solar City. So, Tori, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we've got a pair of stories up on Watchdog.org right now about Solar City, and there are more stories to come. But let's start off with where you started, Tori, by talking to some of Solar City's customers. These were people who were told that they could save hundreds of dollars on their electric bills, or potentially hundreds of dollars on their electric bills, by having solar panels installed on their rooftops. But that's not exactly what happened in every case.
Now, there's several different problems that people have written about on either Yelp or the Better Business Bureau website, or actually on some solar websites as well. And they're complaining about Solar City, which promises that they can have little or no money down and then up to a zero electric bill. But the worst-case scenario was a Northern California man who has a huge house with a lot of electrical things going on, and his electric bill was about $350 a month. So he thought this would be a great deal. However, he lives south of San Francisco, and it's foggy there most of the year, but Solar City told him, no problem, this will be great for you. So it got installed, and not only was it not great and didn't really make very much electricity, his bill actually went up. He ends up paying a lease every month so that he can rent the system from Solar City, and that's their scenario, that no money down. However, you don't own the system. It's rented or leased. So if you tack that onto his electric bill, he was paying about $500 a month.
Yeah, and as bad as that might sound, to know that this company was apparently ripping off a few customers, or at least telling them one thing and when the reality was quite different. I mean, I guess that sort of thing kind of happens all the time. But what really makes this worse in my mind is that Solar City is also, in a way, ripping off all of us taxpayers, because they're getting hundreds of millions of dollars in grants and tax breaks from the federal government. So tell us a little bit about that, too.
Well, the company company has been operating at a loss for the past couple of years, and they have huge investors such as Google, and they've kind of kept it afloat along with the fact that they are getting stimulus money, or have gotten stimulus money, $11 million for that. And then anyone who owns a solar system and puts it on their roof can get a 30% tax rebate from Uncle Sam. And because you and I, if we go to Solar City, we're not going to end up owning the system, but rather leasing it, Solar City gets that tax rebate. And that was approximately $411 million, and it's spread out through the next several years. You have this system on your roof for 20 years. And so it's unclear what's going to happen if the company goes under or if you need a new roof and have to move it. Those are all issues that we're going to be exploring in future Watchdog stories.
So just to be clear about this, they are leasing these systems to people, but Solar City still technically owns the systems, even though it's on your roof or it's on my roof. And that means that Solar City, not the consumer, actually gets the tax credit from the federal government. So even though they're losing money every year, they end up making money because they get to get all these tax credits. Okay, maybe that's taking advantage of a technicality in the law. But all of a sudden, their stock is really hot. This week it was trading up above $80 per share. It was down around $12 per share a little more than a year ago. So it's doing really well. But all this growth seems to be underpinned by this support from the federal government, and it's questionable whether that support is going to continue. So what are some critics saying about what could happen if the government pulls back on some of these solar investment programs?
Well, the incentives are going down from 30% to 10% at the end of 2016. And then who knows how long it's going to be at the 10%. And who knows if they're going to get any more stimulus money. So far they haven't lately. But the stock started out at $8 in December of 2012 when it first went public, and now it's around $86. So everyone's thinking this is the next great thing. But some people out there have been whispering that this could be the next cylinder. I mean, who knows? But it is troubling to some critics that they are funded primarily by this lease program and government incentives, and that could go away. It just doesn't seem like a sound business model, some people say.
That's some really great stuff, Tori. Really good stuff here, but we don't have time to go much further into it, unfortunately. Let's leave off with one more question here. You mentioned Solyndra. Now we have Solar City, which is admittedly a different animal, but it's another green energy company that, by their own admission in their year-end report to the SEC, said that they would not be able to exist without government loans and grant programs existing. Is green energy ever going to be workable without taxpayer handouts like this?
Some of the critics who really do not like the government getting involved in the green energy issue, they say that, and they point to windmills as an example. There are a bunch of incentives if you get some wind farm going or wind energy, and now all those incentives have gone away, and people are out of jobs, and these things are just left as an eyesore not running. And so that very well could happen to solar panels. It's very pricey for the average citizen just to go get a system and put it on their roof. They can't afford it. And so the whole reason why the government got involved in this is because they were pushing green energy and they wanted this to be a viable industry. So by funding part of it, they thought, hey, we can help out here. And then Solar City execs were the first to be smart enough to figure out we can make this an industry if we own these systems rather than selling them to people.
Hey, thanks so much, Tori. Really appreciate you being here for the show. That's unfortunately all the time we have for today. Folks, check out the series of stories about Solar City on Watchdog.org. As always, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at WatchdogORG. I'm Eric Boehm for Watchdog Radio. We'll catch you right back here next week on American Radio Journal.
The principles held dear by Ronald Reagan resulted in an era of conservative governance. Dr. Paul Kangor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College examines those principles on this American Radio Journal commentary.
A rudderless Republican Party, afraid to assert itself in the face of a rising liberal progressive onslaught. A confident Democratic Party in the White House, undermining the nation, its economy, its foreign policy, and with timid Republicans feckless in response. A battle for the heart of the GOP in the next Republican presidential nomination among conservative Republicans and liberal Republicans. Sound familiar? Of course it does. But I'm not just talking about March 2014. I'm also talking about March 1977, when a genuine conservative Republican named Ronald Reagan surveyed the political landscape and saw something hauntingly similar. Reagan resolved to do something about it, and he laid out that vision 27 years ago right now at CPAC, the annual Conservative Political Action Conference, which meets again this March. What Reagan said in that speech remains crucial for conservatives today. Ronald Reagan began speaking at CPAC in 1974, its first gathering. He addressed the faithful 13 times through his final year in the White House. But perhaps his most vigorous defense of conservative thinking came in his remarks delivered in 1977 CPAC, his 66th birthday. Reagan began by exploring his view of conservatism. He said, quote, "Conservative wisdom and principles are derived from willingness to learn, not just from what is going on now, but from what has happened before," unquote. Think about that. Conservatism rests on time-tested principles worth conserving and preserving for the best of the country, its culture, and its people. That's what conservatives believe. Said Reagan, quote, "The principles of conservatism are sound because they're based on what men and women have discovered through experience in not just one generation or a dozen, but in all the combined experience of mankind. When we conservatives say that we know something about political affairs, we are saying that the principles we hold dear are those that have been found through experience to be ultimately beneficial for individuals, for families, for communities, and for nations, found through the often bitter testing of pain or sacrifice and sorrow," unquote. Ronald Reagan insisted that a conservative majority could emerge from within the fractured Republican Party to win back the White House and America. This would require, he said, sticking to principles, conservative principles. Well, what sort of principles? Well, in my new book on Reagan conservatism, I lay out 11 clearly identifiable principles of Reagan conservatism. Here they are: freedom, faith, family, sanctity and dignity of human life, American exceptionalism, the founder's wisdom and vision, lower taxes, limited government, peace through strength, anti-communism, and belief in the individual. Got it? Well, those principles worked for Reagan. He got them. And there's no reason to suspect that they wouldn't work again. They are timeless and time-tested principles. They're not only a prescription for a conservative platform, but they draw a perfect contrast to modern progressivism. Reagan proceeded to unflinchingly hold to those principles. And how successful was that plan? In 1980, pursuing a bold, unapologetic conservative agenda, Reagan won 44 of 50 states against an incumbent president. 4 years later, he won 49 of 50 states. He won those two elections by a combined electoral college margin of 1,014 to 62. Reagan twice won states like California and Massachusetts, Pennsylvania and New Jersey, which Republicans today can only dream of winning twice. When he was finished, liberalism was dead for a generation. The rest is history. Now, liberalism is back in the form of what it's calling progressivism. Could it be defeated again? Perhaps it could, by again adhering to what Ronald Reagan called political principles and to principled politics. This is Paul Kengor for American Radio Journal. Check out my new book, 11 Principles of a Reagan Conservative.
American Radio Journal is heard on over 180 public affairs-minded radio stations in 45 states across the country. They include our newest affiliate, WKHF-FM in Lynchburg, Virginia. Welcome to our new listeners in the Old Dominion. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.